Good evening. Sir Fred Hoyle, the cosmologist, is what's known in the newspapers as a controversial figure. He's a practitioner of the heterodox. And this is why.
The situation about conformity is the following. Where a problem is solved, the conformist opinion is essentially 100% correct all the time. To try to tackle conformist opinion on a solved problem is suicidal. It's right. But on unsolved problems, for the reason I've just given, it will always be the heterodox that is correct. What one doesn't know is which particular form of heterodoxy is going to be the right one.
That's the essence of Fred Hoyle's case against conformity. An orthodox theory in science is certain to be dull and is probably wrong as well. And if you want to discover something new, you need to dabble with the heterodox. And then you'll find, especially if you're a young scientist, that it's hard to find support for your research from public funds. You'll hear that this calculated iconoclasm runs through the whole of Hoyle's scientific work and through his relationships with the rest of the scientific community as well. Now, at 65, he lives in the Lake District, a mile or so away from Ulswater. On fine days, he'll spend a couple of hours walking to the top of some nearby fell. He's as fit as a mountain goat, as I found to my cost one day last year, when I did my best to stay within earshot of him on a much more modest hill. He's very few formal contacts with the rest of the scientific community. He's a visiting professor at University College Cardiff, and from time to time gives public lectures at universities in this country and the United States. He says that he tries to compress these activities into the summer, when the traffic and the tourists occupy the Lake District. As befits an iconoclast, Fred Hoyle is an imaginative person. For what it's worth, he's the most imaginative person I know. And I should declare another interest. I'd like to think that he's a friend of mine. I also have a great admiration for him. And with all that, he's great fun. This raises professional problems. Some of what Hoyle says flies in the face of orthodoxy. I'll do my best to point out the places at which what Hoyle thinks is flatly in disagreement with what most of his contemporaries think. To begin with, you should know that Fred Hoyle is the quintessential Yorkshireman. You can tell that from his speech. Inevitably, he was the brightest student in his small secondary school, wondered for a time about going off to the University of Leeds to study chemistry, but eventually finished up at Emmanuel College, Cambridge, with a mathematics scholarship. What made him, in the 1930s, take up astronomy?
One had to be interested in astronomy if one was a nuclear physicist, because that was the time that Hans Bethe came along with his ideas for the production of nuclear energy in stars. So it was a natural thing to do, to begin to worry a little about problems in astronomy. Furthermore, if one looks backwards in time now, the 1930s and 40s was not the best time in the world for a theoretical physicist.
You mean because of the war?
No, also because of the way things were developing. Theoretical physics was pretty fallow. There'd been this great outburst of quantum mechanics in the mid-1920s. That had carried through into the first half of the 1930s. Due to applications of what had been discovered in quantum mechanics. But by the time one came to the late 1930s, even if there'd been no war, that particular phase of development was really petering out. Mm. And so that was not a good time, if one was trained in theoretical physics, as I was, to be hacking away at problems that were then, from everybody's point of view, insoluble. And so the sidestep into astronomy, which was absolute goldmine for the methods of theoretical physics, because up to that point, astronomers have been quite long on mathematics, but very short on physics. And so stepping across in the early 1940s, or as soon as the war was over, was a very sensible thing to do. I began to use the techniques of physics as they were then known on a variety of problems. But it naturally occurred to me that since I was a theoretical physicist, we don't know everything about physics. Are there any problems that one can see in astronomy that don't seem as though they are going to be solved by well-attested physics? One has to think that it's going to be true. And the most obvious of these was cosmology. And so that was the point of view with which I started.
Yes, you've mentioned Hans Bethe and his explanation of how stars get their energy. That, of course, is a problem that you also took up. I mean, leaving aside now the grand cosmological themes, the explanation of how stars actually produce heavy elements like iron and so on is something that you and Willie Fowler, between you, sorted out in the 50s.
Well, what really happened is I actually started that in 1946, and I started it due to a visit to the Mount Wilson Observatory, and the idea formed in my head due to the late Walter Bader, a conversation with him. What Bethe had done ahead of that time was to think about the nuclear reactions in stars as they begin, the earliest phase. And I began then to think about the later phases, how it went on from what Bethe had done. And I was sort of working away at that in the late 1940s, early 50s. And the thing, as you say, finally gelled together in the middle 50s. We began to see the shape of the problem then quite clearly by the middle 50s. Although a lot of details have still remained to be worked out since then.
Hoyle's mentioned only laconically what's really quite a staggering scientific achievement. In the 1950s, Hoyle and his several collaborators, the nuclear physicist Willie Fowler was only one of them, put together for the first time a complete and enduring theory of how stars win their energy by the conversion of hydrogen into other materials. First helium, then carbon and similar atoms, eventually iron, and even much heavier elements, uranium and unstable elements such as plutonium. Hoyle's voracious appetite for data from other fields of science than his own enabled him to mastermind this ambitious theoretical program. He had the wit to recognize that the successive steps in the thermonuclear conversion of hydrogen into heavier atoms must correspond to the successive stages in the evolution of a star. The stars called red giants, for example, are stars whose hydrogen fuel has been exhausted, converted into helium. And you've heard Hoyle say that one of the attractions of this problem was the wish not to tackle problems that were soluble. It's important to know that 30 years ago, Hoyle was busy with this important theory of the evolution of stars because, of course, he's best known for something quite different: his advocacy of what's called the steady-state theory of the universe. That was a radically new cosmology, an attempt to describe a universe in which all the galaxies are receding from each other like the galaxies in our universe, but in which, on the long view, nothing changes. In reality, the theory had three originators: Hoyle himself and Bondi and Gold working together. But how can any theory like that match reality? How can the universe be expanding all the time, yet stay the same? Only if matter's continuously created to fill up the space vacated by the receding galaxies. That, in the late 1940s, was as radical a notion as anybody could expect. Inevitably, the steady-state theory generated all kinds of opposition. Did Hoyle enjoy that?
No, I never enjoy battling. If I feel I have to do it, I do it. I don't allow myself to be put aside by having to face a battle. But I don't like to choose to fight. When I was a boy, I don't think I ever started an actual fist fight with other boys, but I don't think I ever avoided one if one was forced on me. That was always my philosophy. Now, why there should be such opposition is an interesting question. It could be due to a certain measure of assertiveness on the part of some of the people who are propagandizing for the theory that produced a lot of irritation, and that could well be. But I feel it's deeper than that. And I think it really is the religious bias. Yeah, I think it's the first page of Genesis that was being challenged. And I have come sort of over the years more and more to the view that, with the exception of basic physics, a large fraction of science is sociology and not real science. That's, by real science, I mean taking accord of the facts, whereas by sociology, I mean taking accord of one's prejudices.
Yes, yes, right. And you imply that on this occasion, a lot of the opposition was opposition from people who were just deeply offended that you had said the first book, page of Genesis.
I believe so. I believe so. In retrospect,
but there was no trace of that. There was no trace of that in the arguments that went on in those days.
No, but I think it was touching a raw nerve fibre, as it were. I've come across this much more keenly in my work in the last years, especially as it's touched on biology. I mean, I've now come to realise that the so-called facts on which Darwinian evolution is supposed to be based just don't exist, and that is a theory which is entirely sociology.
Yes, well, we must come to that. But I would like to follow through what happened to the steady-state theory, anyway, because if I understand it correctly, there was a period in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when it seemed, on the basis of newly acquired evidence of distant radio galaxy counts and so on, that steady-state theory didn't account for the facts.
Well, I've always believed, so far as the radio counts were concerned, that they proved nothing either way, that they were like Hubble's counts of galaxies, visual counts of galaxies, and they proved nothing either way. And because the situation was left uncertain, I think it simply allowed those people who didn't want to believe the theory anyway to say the theory was wrong because of the counts. But I've never seen myself anything that was really worth tuppence in that argument. When we got to the microwave background in 1965, that was a different kettle of fish. That was awkward to explain, although one had a sort of curious handle on the problem that there was plenty of energy around to provide for the microwave background. The only issue was how to degrade it in an efficient way. Tommy Gold was much the wisest of any of us at that time, because Tommy said, well, nature is always much better at degrading higher forms of energy into lower forms than we expect, and therefore don't worry about it. I did worry about it, and in trying to calculate the matter, I just made a bad blunder in the turning. I mean, basically what I did, I thought about using microscopic particles to produce the degradation, but I carelessly calculated for more or less spherical particles, whereas if I'd thought of long, thin cylinders, the situation would have been quite different.
Yes.
And I would attribute that to probably a lot of administrative pressures in those years. I just didn't really have the drive and the continuity there in those times to see the problem through.
The point about the microwave background being, I suppose, that here it is with a temperature of 2.8 degrees Kelvin, just a bit above the absolute zero, below the boiling point of helium. And presumably, if it's come from anywhere at all, since there's so much of it, it must have come from a high intensity, high temperature source. And the problem is how to get it from the high temperature to the low temperature.
There's plenty of energy in there. One was not troubled by the amount of energy that was available. It's just that there was high temperature radiation. Yeah. One had to degrade it.
And you found that spherical particles wouldn't do it quickly enough.
They wouldn't do it.
Yes.
No.
Yes. So that seemed for a time to you a bit like a nail in the coffin of the steady
state. Yes, I was rather like Archbishop Cranmer. I lost faith for a while.
Yes. And so how is it that your faith's come back in the past 2 or 3 years? I've heard you talk during that time about the steady state theory revisited and so on.
Well, I would say that really it's because I have vastly more time to work and to think to work at research now than I had in those years. For the last 8 years, I've sort of been free of committee work. I mean, apart from having to earn my living, I've really not had anything else to do except work, and I've been freer in these years than I have since I was a research student, really. It's just the intensity, the amount of effort that I can put in now in 1 year is probably as great as I could put in 5 years in formally.
One of the points which it seems to me very interesting that you've made in this argument about the steady state theory revisited is that, in fact, much of the data used in the late 1950s and early 1960s to discredit the steady state theory has itself turned out, on closer examination, to be false. I mean, is that so? And what kinds of data do you
mean? Microwave background is not quite there. False. It's there, all right.
Misleading,
The present state of play, and I don't know how it's going to go in the future, but the present state of play is that it is not a Planck distribution. And if that is true, then that's goodbye to the Big Bang cosmologies. But it really wouldn't embarrass me particularly if it should turn out that the present positioning has to be revised a little.
Mm. Well, the radio counts. Certainly turned out to be more complicated.
They've turned out to be much more complicated. Well, the way it is, you see, in astronomy, one is faced by the problem of a paucity of facts, especially when one comes to cosmology. Cosmology is notorious for its small range of factual data that's available. And the reason for this is that, obviously, if you're dealing with the universe on the largest scale, one's dealing with big distances, and anything coming from a big distance is bound to be rather feeble, weak intensities, at the limits of instrumental capacity. And as soon as one comes to the limits of instrumental capacity, there's always what one calls a signal-to-noise problem. I'm using signal-to-noise in a generalized sense.
And this is true in any experimental observation.
Yeah. And it's obvious when one has strong prejudices around and one has a rather noisy problem that people are going to start grubbing in the noise and picking up apparent signals. This is really what happened. I wouldn't say that it was anything that was done that was... There were some bits that were really, really bad technically in the observations, but they were the exceptions rather than the rule. The main thing is a lot of noise was converted into signal. That's really what it amounted to.
And people made what they chose.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. So are you saying that on this particular question of the steady-state theory, right or wrong, that you think it's still an open question so far as the experimental data are concerned?
Oh, yes. I think the experimental data favours it now.
Yeah.
And I think that on two counts, the theory must be right. Firstly, that the high-grade physics is now turning up the terms of the right shape, and one can't have some of them without having them all, so I think that almost makes it a foregone conclusion. And I happen to hold certain views that are personal to me that also seem to make it a foregone conclusion.
Let me ask about the steady-state cosmology and the link with high-energy physics. Are you thinking there on the physics side of these new theories called grand unification or quantum chromodynamics or whatever other term?
It's the grand unification theory. But I also hold the view that when physicists say they have a grand unification theory, they really haven't. They've unified it up to their present perceptions. But there is going to be a still bigger structure. There are going to be transformations, if one likes to put it mathematically, that involve still the higher spaces.
Yes.
And by the time all this has been put together, it has to produce the required shape. Mm. If some of it's there, you see, the point is, if some of it's there, then the rest have to be there. I think perhaps I ought to say something about this question of style, because it's a point that I learned from Paul Dirac. I was very lucky in 1939, being one of the very few research students that Dirac ever would take. And the reason we got on together is I never worried him, and he never worried me, so we were fine. But Paul always used to be at me and saying, "Harl, you're too worried about details. You must think..." Dirac always referred to it as the beauty of physics, but I would call it style. And if I might give you an example of style, up to 1905, various people like Fitzgerald, Poincaré, Lorentz were very close to the theory of special relativity, and they did quite a bit of the thinking on it.
But the crucial point
of style occurred in 1905 when Einstein said, I am going to accept that the velocity of light is the same for every observer in uniform motion. Yeah. And once he had said that point of style will override all details, from then onwards everything was fixed. Mm.
You imply that then this successful style in physics is a daring style. Is that right?
It's always a daring style. And that was the crucial thing that I learnt from Dirac, and it was that really paid off in 1948.
You'll have gathered that Hoyle, at least, isn't persuaded that the steady-state theory should be abandoned. He's explained that he was never seriously put off by the evidence which accumulated in the early 1960s, suggesting that the distribution of distant galaxies in the universe did not accord with the steady-state theory, but that he was personally so dismayed by the discovery of the microwave background radiation that seems to fill the universe that for a time in the mid-1960s, he lost his faith. But now, he says, his faith's come back. He's able to see how the microwave background radiation might have arisen in ways that don't imply that it's a relic of some big bang with which the universe began. And he's convinced that the new theories of matter developed in high-energy physics show that he's been right all along. I think Coyle's right to complain about the quality of the data on which, in the early 1960s, the arguments against the steady-state theory were based. The microwave background's a different kettle of fish. It's such an unexpected ingredient of the universe that it's hard to see what precisely to make of it. Hoyle's surely right, on the other hand, to say that the attempts now being made to bring together the microscopic theories of elementary particles, the grand unification program, as he called it, may throw some light on the problem. The ideal, it seems to me, is that there should be a kind of moratorium on these huge cosmological questions for a decade or so, until people have had time to digest the wealth of data now being accumulated about the properties of distant galaxies. This doesn't mean that there aren't serious questions in cosmology that can and should be answered. For example, is the expansion of the universe slowing down? But the more that's known, the harder it seems to be conclusively to tell whether we live in a steady-state universe or whether it all began with a Big Bang. The trouble is that such questions are too intriguing to leave alone. Fred Hoyle has explained how he was dragged in. His most recent exploit of this kind is even more daring. With his friend and colleague from Cardiff, Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe, Hoyle spent much of the past 5 years urging that people should take seriously his theory that life as we know it exists not only on the surface of the Earth, but is indeed scattered throughout space, at least throughout our galaxy, perhaps in other galaxies as well. There are all kinds of dazzling corollaries. For example, the puzzling occurrence of worldwide influenza pandemics is said in the theory to be the result of injections of influenza viruses into the upper atmosphere, perhaps carried there by comets. Let me say quite openly that many people, perhaps even most people, don't believe that such processes occur. So it's perhaps important to know where the ideas come from. Did it, I asked him, spring from the discovery by radio astronomers of organic molecules in the denser clouds of gas and dust between the stars?
To some extent, it did, but I had been involved since 1940 with thinking about this, and together with Ray Littleton, I wrote a paper at that time in which we predicted molecular structures, particularly hydrogen molecules. And from that, they developed through the 1940s and 50s a strong component in my thinking that dense clouds would be great accumulations of molecules. And it was because the radio astronomers of that time said that it couldn't be so from their observations that I dropped it as a serious scientific project. As I say, I'm speaking back now 25 years. and turned it into a story in a novel called The Black Cloud, which I wrote at that time. And the reason I wrote it was I went to fiction when I felt, when I was being told that I couldn't.
Give us an idea that.
But I had it deeply within myself that the interstellar gases had to be thick with organic molecules right from the early 50s, certainly. In the early 1960s, 10 years after that, I got a check from Ceylon, Chandra Wickramasinghe, as a research student, and I started him on the problem of interstellar grains. I was quite dissatisfied with the conventional theory at that time that they were ice grains, which has now been shown cannot be true from the lack of absorptions in the infrared.
Characteristic of water.
Characteristic, very strong absorptions in the ice, characteristic of water. And the idea that we tried to develop was that they were graphite grains. And I think this had some success. It predicted very strong absorption of ultraviolet light, which was shortly afterwards shown to be true from new rocket experiments. But when we really tried to calculate exactly, although we'd had these successes, it really did seem as though there was graphite there, we could never be satisfied. I always remember Kepler, that he got the better theory than Copernicus, but it was because he wasn't satisfied with the fine print, as it were, that he was finally led to his breakthrough. And we were just in that kind of position, that we just could not make things fit really well. And it became more puzzling because this was not a noisy situation. It wasn't a signal-to-noise problem, because we were getting the same behavior of interstellar grains from all over the place, you know, in all parts of the galaxy, and to some extent now even outside our galaxy. So it was a sort of unavoidable problem, and Chandra, over the years after we ceased to work together over the late 60s, he kept hammering away at this problem. He tried putting ice on cores of graphite and all this multiple components.
Silicates came into it.
Silicates, yes, we invented the silicates a little ahead of the discovery of the silicates. And we had all these things in and heavy computer studies, but we could never make it work. And after I'd left Cambridge in 72, I began to think again about this problem. As I said before, I had plenty of time. And it became almost a neurosis, because there were the observations. We could see that there were only a few elements that the particles could be built up from. I mean, basically, not many more than half a dozen.
The measurements consist of the absorption by these grains.
Yes, of distant starlight. You have a star which is a source of light, and you know from comparing a distant star with a similar nearby star how the light started out, and then you can see how you receive it, and from what's happened to it on the way, you can deduce the particles. One very outstanding property of the solid particles is that they are of a quite uniform size, of about 0.7 microns diameter, if one thinks of them as spheres, or if one thinks of them as cylinders, around 0.7 microns for the diameter of the cylinder.
But rather longer than that.
The length is the free parameter. So one had to again worry what kind of a particle can be made in a sort of inorganic way that always reproduces itself as a standard structure. The commonest atoms that one had to make the grains out of was carbon, hydrogen, oxygen and nitrogen. These are the commonest, and we could easily see from the amount of absorption that is produced that one has to use those materials. And what do they make? Well, they make organic materials. And this was really a traumatic moment for us. I mean, it wasn't a thing that we came to lightly. It was a real neurotic situation to have to face the possibility that in the galaxy there is a huge quantity of organic material. And we simply saw it in that form to begin with, that it was just organic the way an organic chemist might make it. Not at all in the biological sense.
Made by
random processes, that's the way. But then we began to worry and worry, always calculating and trying to get the calculations to fit the observations, and being worried about this uniformity of size of particle, until again a very traumatic situation. You say to yourself, well, what if this was biological? And once the question is raised in your mind, you say straight away, well, if it is biological, we know a lot about biology from the lab, and therefore we have a lot of data. For example, data of particle sizes, that kind of thing. We can use this data and we can now calculate again. And now what we found, and this was a real punch in the solar plexus, what we found is when we calculated now, things came out right. So here we were with a history of almost 15 years of desperately trying to make inorganic theories work and failing to do so, and then finding at the first touch, as soon as we changed the picture, it all fitted together. And so this was the start of gradually sort of facing one question after another. And no question along the route did I find easy. I remember the day that I began to wonder whether it could be true that major astronomical processes could have a biological connotation. I thought to myself, I really have gone down around the bend today. And eventually I had to say, well, this is something that has to be seriously thought about.
One thing you'll notice leads to another. You start by wondering whether there's organic chemistry out there in space, and you finish up believing that there's fully fledged life out there. It's a big leap in the dark by any standards. So why, you'll ask, does a nice Yorkshireman like Fred Hoyle bother making all that trouble in the process? It's all a little puzzling, you'll say, but he's given you a clue already. Earlier on, when we were talking about the steady-state theory of the universe, and the reasons why some people were so opposed to it, he mentioned disparagingly what he called the so-called facts on which Darwinism is based. I got a straighter answer when I asked him a straighter question. What had led him, emotionally, I suppose, to the notion of there being life in space?
Well, I think it was just a growing perception as I read more about biology that a terrestrial theory was inadequate. I began to see how very, very complicated the whole structure of microbiology is, and I think this would have been clear much quicker to someone with an expert knowledge of microbiology than it was to me. But as I read it, I could see that the structure of enzymes, structure of histones, the transfer RNA molecules, all these things, as well, of course, as the logic of how cells operate, which is still a very big unresolved problem, that these were not likely to have been shuffled together just in a random sort of way, that this just won't work. It's bad enough to understand how one produces a polymer, a polypeptide, just stringing the amino acids together in any sort of order. The real question is, how does one find the order that contains the relevant information for enzymes, the relevant shapes?
Now, the conventional biological view is that all this is done by natural selection. You start with a primeval soup maybe 3,000 million years ago, and simply because the molecules the most able to reproduce themselves are the ones that get selected in due course, you find that you finish up with the optimum lifestyle. And you say, even so, it's incredible that it could have happened.
Well, I think this conventional explanation is just a delusion. One doesn't necessarily, just by selecting for reproducibility, produce anything that's complex in the form of information. That doesn't happen with the rocks on the surface of the Earth. I think unless one selects against an environment that already contains the information, this argument is an illusion. If one could say the environment had the information already built into it, well and good.
That would imply a kind of teleological evolution in which the nature of evolving things was determined by what the world was going to be like at some time in the future.
I think these views really come from a situation in which biologists have believed very deeply from their training, what they've been taught by their teachers, when they were learning the subject, that it happened that way, and they really haven't brought themselves to think it through, just what is needed even to produce one biomolecule like histone 4, which seems to have a unique amino acid structure across the whole face of biology. Because as soon as one begins to calculate numbers, it's very clear that the numbers are truly astronomical. If one simply starts trying things, it just doesn't
work. Suppose you say you get one new nucleotide every million generations, and then how long does a million generations take?
It just doesn't stack up. For a while, when I began to think that what we're really seeing is a bit of a cosmic scheme where life is concerned, the biochemistry of life, that this is part of a very large-scale cosmic affair, I was relieved because I could see that on a cosmic scale one had a situation that was more powerful than the terrestrial one by something like 10 to the 20, one with 20 zeros. And that seemed like an enormous gain in strength. Mm. But even that does not seem sufficient to me now. I'm so overwhelmed by the complexity that if you say to me you can have the whole of our galaxy, all the galaxies you see, I still cannot see how any form of shuffling by natural processes can produce this system.
One other group of people that's been so alarmed by the complexity of living things that they've said it can't happen the way the biologists say are, of course, the creationists. The creationists,
yes.
The people who say, it's all done once and for all by God.
Yes.
Again, on the first book of Genesis. Mm. How do you distinguish your position from theirs? I mean, I assume it is distinct.
No, I'm not sure that it is. I'm worried by the same problem. I would say that I'm worried because I face it. I face the facts. And I don't think these people have got a bad argument. And it worries me because I would like them to be wrong.
Hmm.
But I don't think it would be necessary to go as far as they go and then say, well, everything has been suddenly created by God. I think that is a non sequitur. I mean, all one is really saying is that there is an information content in the universe that is enormous when it shows in its most dramatic form in living systems, and that a short time scale for the whole universe is quite inadequate to provide for that information. In some way, the universe has been evolving over enormous spans of time towards a high level of information. And it is
and that this has guided the evolution of living things
by
conventional mechanisms.
This would be my picture,
yes.
But I wouldn't,
yes.
As it were, jump into over a precipice as the creationists do. No, but I think their point of view has to be faced.
You've really, in a sense, been defining implicitly what you mean by religious in this connection. You've been saying you think there are things in the universe that, in a sense, precondition, predetermine what's happened to us, what may even happen to the universe.
Well, I would even go so far as to say that almost all that is seen in the universe is a product of intelligence. That just if an observer came down to the surface of the Earth, and for example, in the district here, and saw all the wall fields, they would see that the actual rock structures are not a product of intelligence. They've been product of natural processes. But the walls that run up the hills, they would say that an intelligence is involved there in the roads and so forth, the houses, and I think that this is true in many astronomical processes, that what we are seeing are products of intelligence. I don't think it's at all widely understood, and not certainly not admitted by astronomers, but for a generation or more, there are many problems that have been under attack where only the vaguest suggestions of an answer have been given. For example, how do stars form? What decides what the mass of a star should be? Really, will a star have a set of planets? You know, questions like this.
Yes.
What causes the spiral arms of galaxies? There's a whole range of these things.
Why are most galaxies within an order of magnitude in size?
Yes, things of that kind. There are uneasy answers to these which convince most astronomers, that they understand it. I just don't believe they understand it. In the sense that if an atom emits certain spectrum lines, we do understand that. We can calculate that problem precisely. We know just what's going to happen. There's none of that at all about a whole slew of problems in astronomy. And I'm afraid my unorthodox view is that we're looking up the walls going up the hillside.
Yes, I see. And And what was the intelligence that put these things there in the first place?
Dunno. Dunno, that's the hunt, of course. That's what one would have to hunt for. One could make all sorts of theories or speculations, but whether these are right, the only way I can see that one can make an enzyme correctly to do its function is the way a human chemist would do it. If you specify to a human chemist, as long as you put the amino acid in such and such an order for your polypeptide, you will get a structure that will act catalytically in relation to a certain inorganic chemical reaction. As long as you formulated the question that way, the human, if he was a good chemist, would make the correct product. And that's the only way that I really think this system can be made. As it were, by working it out, seeing how it has to be done, and then deliberately making it.
It's almost like Adam Smith's invisible hand. Is the search to identify the invisible hand now a part of your scientific
work? That's right,
yes.
That's right, to look for the invisible hand.
Well, that's a rum conclusion, you'll say. Here's Fred Hoyle, who spent the whole of his life looking for explanations of the way in which mechanistic processes can account for the way the world is, now saying he's going to spend the rest of his life looking for the invisible hand that made it the way it is. I must confess that our conversation on this subject is more than a little elliptical. There are also lots of statements in it that can be argued about. For example, there's Hoyle's belief that there cannot possibly have been enough time since the beginning of the solar system for living things to have evolved the forms they now have. Not everybody agrees. And it's just as fair to argue that if the lifetime of living things on the surface of the Earth is short, that's simply a proof of the economy of the apparatus of inheritance. And in any case, there's no yardstick for telling how quick or slow evolution should have been. But as a journalist, I think that if there's any sense in which Fred Hoyle has found God, or God Fred Hoyle, then that's news. For myself, as you'll have gathered, I'd be sorry if that were the implication of our conversation. My comfort would be to know that religious people wouldn't find him an easy convert. Being Fred Hoyle, he'd want to know what makes God tick, and he'd have a theory for it. Good night.